Hope everybody's doing well. You guys hear me?
Yep.
Okay. Few of you may know me because you're in Department of Immunology. I don't know if maybe many of you don't. But we're here for you. So here is my contact information. You can reach me by email. If you have any questions about the lecture or any questions about the immunology sections to this course, just because we teach a specific lecture, we as immunologists feel that we should be able to answer any other questions you may have as they apply to the other three lectures I believe you had in immunology. You know, particularly if other faculty are not here and you can reach me, just let me know. I'll try to answer your questions. I didn't include my telephone number here, but it's extension 4375. So if you're on campus, just dial that number, or it's 845-4375. Okay? So I'll be here. I'm not going to go away for the holidays, so if you need to talk about any of the material, just send me an email, give me a call. Okay. So this is the last lecture. It will involve what I believe important concepts in the area of adaptive immunity. And you've had one or two prior lectures about B cell responses or humoral immunity, which leads to the production of antibodies. And, before I move into T cell biology, which is the other major element of adaptive immunity, I just wanted to review on this slide because I think it's important to compare and contrast what I've been talking about. So B cells versus T cells. Which arm of the immune system is likely to be more relevant for antiviral or anti-tumor responses? And really, that's the big question. And you've learned about B cells and the importance of antibodies, but there is an important distinction between these two responses that really will tell you why T cells are more relevant, particularly in cancer. So the first concept, again, is to reiterate that antibodies produced by B cells recognize pathogens outside the cell. It's called extracellular. Whereas T cells, T lymphocytes, T stands for thymus or thymus derived, because they are educated within the thymus. They originate from the bone marrow, just like all blood cells. But they actually develop, mature, and differentiate into a T cell, which then exits into the circulation through the thymus, and that's where the T comes from, thymus. So T cells recognize pathogens, again, viruses, bacteria, fungi, as well as tumors, but through a pathway that requires intracellular processing of that pathogen. And that pathogen is not directly recognized by T cells. T cells recognize fragments derived from those pathogens. And we're going to go through that pathway in a little bit more detail. But this is a very important concept. So B cells produce antibodies which bind to circulating pathogens or toxins, leading to neutralization of pathogenic activity. There are a number of other mechanisms that antibodies use to neutralize pathogens, but the one I just want to point out up here, which is the main one, is their ability to bind to the pathogenic product and keep it from binding to receptors on cell surfaces, so it's sort of like competition. So if the antibody effectively removes the pathogen or the pathogen fragment, the toxin, from circulation, there is less interaction with cells, leading to disease or a change in health. T cells, in contrast, directly bind to the abnormal cell. And again, it could be an infected cell, it could be neoplastic, and then this will ultimately lead to the destruction of that cell. So again, important concepts. And if I'm not clear on any particular side, just raise your hand. I want to make sure you appreciate these fundamental concepts that I'll be talking about. Okay, so, but how did this all happen? So this is sort of like a confocal image of what a T cell looks like and what an antigen presenting cell looks like. And what happens really is that in order for all this to happen, T cell, which is shown in green, and you can see there are a number of different T lymphocytes, and they take on these very pleomorphic morphologies because that's a sign of activation and movement. And what they're binding to in this particular example is a dendritic cell. And the dendritic cell, again, is derived from, it's a blood cell, it's derived from the myeloid lineage of hematopoiesis. And these cells have an exquisite ability to activate T cells. It's the most effective myeloid population, the most effective cell that can activate T cells. And these cells express a number of different ligands that are recognized by various types of receptors on the surface of a T cell. And what you can see here in this dendritic cell, it's very big, it's very pleomorphic, and it gets the name because of these dendrites, dendritic cell dendrites. So they look like neurons. So about 40 years ago, when dendritic cells were first discovered, that's where they got their name, because they look like neurons, so they have these dendrites. In fact, the individual that discovered dendritic cells 40 years ago, Ralph Steinman, I think about 5-6 years ago, somewhere within the last 10 years, won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for the discovery of dendritic cells. And it's very interesting because this was, again, the Nobel Prizes are awarded in October, and about 1 or 2 days before the Nobel Prize in Medicine was announced, Dr. Steinman had died. And when the announcement came out, I mean, that's already planned basically for the year. The announcement came out, and obviously he had passed away. And the Nobel Committee typically does not present awards to any scientist that's deceased. But because of the unusual circumstances, they gave the award, of course, to him. His wife accepted the award in his honor. But it goes to show you the power of immunology and the importance of immunology to medicine. In fact, about, I think, 1/5 to 1/3 of the Nobel Prize winners, probably the last, 50 to 80 years, have been immunologists or immunology-related research. This is what it looks like. So you can have multiple T cells binding to a single dendritic cell, because a single dendritic cell has many receptors, and they have the capacity to present a significant number of different antigenic determinants, antigenic sequences that are recognized by individual T cells. A very efficient process. And those interactions eventually lead to T cell activation and engagement of your effector functions. So let's talk a little bit about what these green cells are. So there are a lot of different flavors of T cells. We call them by different names. Immunology is very good at coming up with a lot of different complex names and abbreviations. But only three I want to talk about for today. So there are three major types. You have your cytotoxic T lymphocyte, which is actually the T cell that does the killing. Then there are two main populations of what's called helper T cells, and that's what the H stands for, helper. There are multiple subtypes of helper cells. I'm only showing two here because they're relevant for the concepts I'm trying to discuss today. You have a type 1, or Th1, and you have a type 2, or Th2. These are very important because they each do different things for a living. The Th1 population of helper cells plays a very important role in the generation of cytotoxic T cells. So they help in the development of these cytotoxic T cells. And I'll show you a slide on that. Whereas the type 2 population is very important in helping the production of antibodies from B cells. So very different roles. And it's very important that the immune system regulates these two different populations in order to develop the appropriate immune reaction. So if you want an anti-tumor response and the production of a Th2 response culminates instead of a Th1 response, that can actually interfere with the cytotoxic T cell generation. And if you don't generate your cytotoxic T cells, there's less likelihood that you'll be able to inhibit the tumor growth. Okay? So very different roles for these populations of cells. So now I want to get back to that green slide, but talk about how all this happens. How do we take a CD8 positive cytotoxic T cell or CD4 positive T helper 1 or T helper 2 T cell and go from a state of resting state to a state of activation? So we call them naive T cells. Once they're activated, they're an activated cell. They develop either regulatory functions or effector functions. So the role of the antigen-presenting cell is very critical to this activation. Okay, so you already have this image of how the green cell binds to that red cell. But how does this interaction actually lead to activation? So you can transition from the naive or quiescent state to a very active functional state. So dendritic cells are essential for the induction of the naive T cell response. And it does so through the regulation of three major events known as the three signal model. Again, these are three major signals, but there are other types of interactions that occur. But just for the purpose of this lecture, I just want to emphasize three major events must happen to go from a naive state to an activated state. So step number one, and this is a really critical concept in immunology, is called MHC restriction. M stands for major, H stands for histocompatibility, and C stands for complex. This is the major protein expressed on all your cells, of every cell of your body except for mature red cells. Every cell of your body expresses these MHC proteins. These MHC proteins determine who you are genetically. It identifies you as self. And the whole important purpose of self is that the immune system, whether it's T cells or B cells, need to distinguish self from non-self. So if the T cell sees self, your MHC proteins, in the absence of any infection, in the absence of any alteration to a normal cell, there's no activation. So these MHC proteins are synonymous with who you are, self. And the whole purpose of an infection, inflammation, cancer leads to an alteration of self, and that's what ultimately activates T cell. But it's not just that. That's important for interaction and recognition. But there are a number of other events that ultimately lead to activation, replication, cell division, and production of an army of T cells that now you need to clear the infection or the tumor. So recognition of MHC. Now, MHC alone will turn off T cell because it's just synonymous with self. So in order for the T cell to see that self as foreign, that MHC protein now commingles or associates with a foreign peptide derived from that pathogen. So remember, if it's an infection, the virus enters the cell, there's going to be a certain type of series of events that are activated within the antigen-presenting cell, the dendritic cell, and that's going to lead to a degradation of these viruses and the re-expression of segments or fragments of those viruses on the cell surface, and these associations happen with the MHC protein. It'll form almost like a groove within the MHC protein. Okay? And we'll go through a little bit of this in more detail. So the antigen-presenting cell, so obviously the pathogen starts the whole process. The antigen-presenting cell has to be able to recognize that pathogen. And in a variety of different ways, alters the biology of that pathogen through a process called antigen processing. So it's internalized through a variety of different mechanisms, a consequence of that internalization, degradation of the pathogen, leading to the production of these fragments. These fragments then commingle with MHC molecules, forming a complex on the cell surface, and that's what the T cell receptor must see. Now, in addition to that, there are other components for productive antigen recognition, in addition to the T cell receptor, and that includes co-receptors. Remember, on one slide I showed you that there are multiple flavors of T cells. You have the CD8 or the CD4. And those are just names we gave historically to distinguish cytotoxic T cells from helper T cells. So CD4 or CD8 are synonymous with co-receptors because T cells express these receptors and they're going to bind to other molecules on the antigen-presenting cell. In addition to that, you need other interactions. Interactions involving adhesion molecules, like LSA1 expressed on the T cell surface, will bind to ICAM1 on the antigen-presenting cell surface. There's another adhesion molecule interaction which involves CD2 on the T cell surface, and that binds to LFA3 on the antigen-presenting cell. And the importance of these interactions is that you form a more stable conjugate. So imagine if you just had an interaction with a single receptor. It's not stable enough. The complex will dissociate and it won't create a stable interaction long enough to lead to T cell activation. So these additional interactions involving co-receptors and adhesion molecules are really critical to improving the stability of the conjugate between the T cell and the antigen-presenting cell. Okay. But that in itself is still not enough to activate the T cell. This must happen first. Then there's another set of receptor ligand interactions that are called co-stimulation. And that's where the word co comes from. This is a set of interactions that involve receptors on the T cells and again ligands on the antigen presenting cell that lead to an enhanced state of T cell activation, because it's important in the production of cytokines that are then produced either by the antigen-presenting cell or by the T cell, which are really critical in clonal expansion, as well as differentiation from naive to effector cell. So T cells will express on the surface a molecule called CD28, and that can bind to a ligand on the surface of the dendritic cell called CD80. Or there's another interaction between CD28 and another ligand on the antigen-presenting cell called CD86. The third thing that must happen is, as a consequence of this interaction, this receptor ligand interaction between CD28 and 80, or CD28 and 86, this leads to the upregulation of the IL-2 receptor on the surface of the T cell, the production of IL-2, which stands for interleukin 2. So what that means is IL-2 is one of the most important growth factors for T cells. Without IL-2, you can't go from one T cell to a million cells. So the whole idea with this whole process, there is a lot of programming that's happening within the T cell, which leads to both quantitative effects, in other words, the expansion of the army, as well as qualitative changes which affect how they function. And I'm not going to go into all the genetic events that distinguish the two. Just to point out that these are the three major interactions or processes that must occur to transition from a naive state to an activated state. And again, I'm just going to reemphasize these ideas in different ways because they're really critical. So this is just from a textbook. This is one of the textbooks we use in one of our courses in immunology, and I think it's very, very good for illustrating this concept again. So if you look at whether it's a CD4 cell or a CD8 cell, okay, there are certain differences that I'm going to point out. But let's look at a CD8 cell, for example. So here is the T cell receptor. Of course, there was an error in the book. I don't know why they had these little these little quote marks. It shouldn't be there. It should be a dash, not a quote mark. I guess textbooks do have errors. So this is the T cell receptor and a variety of other proteins that make up the T cell receptor. Don't worry about CD3 or any of this stuff on the side. I just want to emphasize that on the surface of your T cell, once it exits the thymus, circulates in the blood or homes and resides within lymph nodes, these T cells will have T cell receptors, and they're constantly in search of alterations of self. They're constantly in search for some type of damage. So here's a little structure of the T cell receptor. It consists of two chains, an alpha and a beta chain, and its sole purpose is to recognize alterations of self. So here is the MHC protein, and the protein is associated with a small protein fragment. As I mentioned, these protein fragments are embedded within the groove of that MHC protein. It's this complex that is then seen by the T cell receptor. So if this peptide right here, this small protein fragment, was not in that groove, there would be no T cell activation. If this peptide was in the groove of a different MHC protein, you may or may not get the right T cell response. Okay? So the two must align together in order to get specific interaction between the T cell receptor and this complex. Here are the co-receptor interactions that I was talking about. Here it is for CD8, here it is for CD4. This co-receptor interaction involves binding of the CD8 molecule to a non-polymorphic sequence on the MHC protein. And that strengthens this interaction between the T cell receptor and the MHC peptide complex. Okay? Here are the interactions that I referred to in terms of adhesion. So here you have CD2 on the surface of the T cell, recognizing LFA3 on the surface of the antigen-presenting cell, and here you have LFA1 recognizing ICAM1 on the surface of the antigen-presenting cell. Don't be too concerned about the names other than the concept that you need these co-receptor interactions. The second signal was through co-stimulation, and that's shown here, CD28, recognizing its ligand on the surface of the antigen-presenting cell, hence termed CD80 or 86. Okay? A couple important differences now, and you're going to see this on the next couple of slides. The MHC proteins are extremely complex and extremely diverse, but generally they fall into two classes, class 1 and class 2. CD8-positive cytotoxic T lymphocytes are required to see MHC class 1. In contrast, CD4-positive T cells see a completely different class of MHC proteins called class 2. But the fundamentals of the interactions are the same. They just recognize different forms of the protein. They also recognize proteins derived from different compartments within the cell, and I'll go on to describe antigen processing in a moment. Any questions so far? I'm trying to be very good because I don't know all your background in immunology, so I want to make sure I cover these concepts, which covers anybody from, just basic knowledge of immunology and again, to advanced knowledge in immunology. I just want to be all on the same page. So this combines, this slide illustrates this concept in a different way. And again, as I showed you in that slide, with the green cell binding to a red cell, multiple T cells combine to a single dendritic cell. And that's shown here. So here is your dendritic cell. Here the labels were a little bit different, but the points are the same. Signal 1 is between the T cell receptor and the MHC protein. Don't worry about the name. This is just the name of the protein, whether it's class 2. Here is a similar interaction with the CBA cell, again, through the T-cell receptor, recognizing the MHC peptide complex in a class 1 restricted manner, and shows you the CBA interaction, or the CB4 interaction here. And again, signal 2. That a consequence of engagement of signal 2 leads to an increase in IL-2 receptor expression on both CD8 and CD4 cells, as well as the production of IL-2, mainly from CD4 cells. Naive CD8 cells, even after activation, do not produce a lot of IL-2. And that's where the helper function really comes in from the CD4 cell. The helper, pretty much in the context of providing a major source of interleukin-2, which, as I pointed out, is a major growth factor for the amplification of one cell to many cells. Remember, you're trying to form an army to kill cancer. You can't do it without IL-2. Okay, I just want to back up for a moment and talk a little bit more about signal 1, because, again, this is a really important concept of MHC restriction. And this shows you, you know, what would happen if you don't have the right mix. Again, it's from a textbook. So, let me just read through this and I'll go through this. So, antigen specificity is governed by the T-cell receptor. Every T-cell receptor sees a single MHC peptide complex. Doesn't see multiple, it sees only one. So, for every T-cell in your body, it is specifically programmed to see one MHC molecule in combination with one peptide. That's how powerful this is. Each peptide within the group of an MHC molecule is only, in class 1, is only about 8 to 10 amino acids in length. That's what the T-cell sees. It's a really amazing, sophisticated system. For CD4, MHC class 2 interactions, it's the same principle. Sees a single MHC peptide complex, but in that case, the peptides are a little bit longer. It's about 13 to 18 amino acids in length. So specificity is purely governed by the T-cell receptor. And if it doesn't see that alteration in MHC, you will not get a productive interaction. So this T-cell receptor recognizes an antigenic peptide. Again, it is a peptide because it's a small fragment of a protein. It's antigenic because antigens in immunology imply that they are foreign components of some sort of pathogenic process. So they recognize these peptides in the context of MHC, which again is self, and this is altogether a concept known as MHC restriction. MHC restriction is absolutely essential. I think that's kind of redundant, absolutely essential, but I said it that way because I really want to drive home that message. To ensure and instruct immune reactivity against alterations of self. Now, obviously there are cases, and there may be cases in your own family or, you know, friends that have autoimmune diseases. It could be lupus, it could be arthritis, it could be psoriasis, it could be Crohn's disease, multiple sclerosis, a number of disorders are due to a defect in the ability to regulate reactions against self. That's called autoimmunity. Okay? I'm not going to be discussing autoimmunity, but the consequence of recognizing self will lead to that kind of damage. Yet, MHC class 1 for a little bit more detail, I just want to show here. So for a CD8 positive T cell, the MHC molecule really is composed of two chains, what we call the heavy and light chain, and an MHC class 2 protein is also composed of two chains, but the two chains are equal in size. So let me just go through here. It's a very simple diagram. So here's your T cell receptor. It recognizes the MHC peptide complex on the surface of your antigen-presenting cell, and if it recognizes the right MHC type in combination with the right peptide, you will get recognition and ultimately activation. In this case, you may not have this You may not have the right MHC molecule, even though you may have the right peptide. You can see here, just for graphic purposes. In that case, if it's the wrong MHC protein with the right MHC with the right peptide, there's still no activation. In this case, you may have the same MHC protein, but an incorrect peptide, and again, no activation. That's MHC restricted. Again, about 50, 60 years ago, Zinkelnagel and Daugherty were the scientists who discovered this concept and went on to win the Nobel Prize in medicine. So what I'm really trying to tell you is become immunologists. Okay, so how do these peptides get on the cell surface? So this slide is just going to be a reminder of me to go through two major mechanisms. Okay, let's talk about class 1 and CD8 responses. And again, I'm just going to go through this very quickly. I'm not going to get into the biochemistry of all this. But peptides that are presented by MHC class 1 molecules are processed in a very different way than peptides that associate with MHC class 2 molecules. So, in the case of CD8 cells, this pathway is called endogenous. In the case of CD4, it's called exogenous. So, an endogenous pathway of antigen uptake basically reflects infection. So, if you have something like a virus, viruses are a great example. The viruses either directly enter the cell by damaging the membrane, or they're taken up by some receptor. After that interaction, they find their way into the cytoplasm of the cell. That means endogenous. So within the cytoplasm of the cell, that's where the virus is now not only trying to replicate, but it's also being destroyed by the dendritic cell. It's also in that compartment where MHC class 1 proteins are synthesized. Again, long story short, obviously you have to go through the ER and the Golgi, etc., but I'm not going to go through all those details. But the whole idea is that's where MHC class 1 proteins also commingle. And so they're in the right compartment at the right time. So you'll have viral infection, viral degradation, you have MHC class 1 synthesis, and it's within that same compartment of the cytoplasm you will have association. Obviously, that's a very complex process. Some of it is random, much of it is not. The end result is re-expression of the MHC class 1 protein in association with the energetic peptide. In contrast, MHC class 2 proteins present peptides derived through a different mechanism called exogenous processing. So basically, that involves something like phagocytosis or endocytosis. So it's not really an active process due to infection, but it's more of a passive process due to phagocytosis or endocytosis. In that case, the protein could be a toxin that's circulating in the blood, is taken up through a lysosomal-based pathway. So now it's encapsulated within the cell within special vesicles. And it's within those vesicles, these endosomes, lysosomes, where MHC class 2 proteins happen to commingle. And it's within those vesicles where you will now get interaction between MHC class 2 and antigenic peptides derived from proteins that could be circulating in the blood. Okay? So, in this case, the association happens in the cytoplasm. In this case, the association with MHC occurs within endocytic vesicles. And I'm going to summarize all this in maybe the next slide. Okay, a word about signal 2 and signal 3 again. And again, this is from the textbook, just to reiterate the concept in a different way. And that is you have your interaction between your T cell, and in this case it could be a 4 or an 8, with your antigen-presenting cell, which is your could be your dendritic cell. Again, long story short, not everything is shown on this slide or in this cartoon. But again, you see the interaction between the T-cell receptor with the MHC peptide complex on the surface of the antigen-presenting cell, signal one. Signal two is that co-stimulatory signal. And as I pointed out, one of the consequences of engaging signal two leads to two events. One is the upregulation of the IL-2 receptor, and two is the production of IL-2. So in order for the cell to respond to IL-2, it needs to enhance expression of the receptor. So as a consequence of signal one, two, and three, you have lots of IL-2 production. IL-2 binds to these activated T cells, leading to clonal, what we call clonal expansion. In other words, you go from one cell to many cells. And now you transition from a naive state to an activated state. Once the pathogen is cleared or the inflammation is resolved, then you have a contraction of the immune reaction. Much of those T cells will die because there's no longer presence of any antigen. And some of them, a small fraction, will reside for a long period of time and differentiate into memory cells. And that's what this slide at the bottom represents. And it's these memory cells that exist in various parts of your body, lymph nodes, bone marrow, where they reside for long periods of time, maybe for your life, where if you're re-exposed to that same pathogen, you will respond in a quicker, more robust, and sensitive way to clear that pathogen. So if you're re-exposed, your body's prepared to fight that infection or pathological process again. And it's due to the presence of these memory cells that linger for many years to come. Okay, so to summarize this part of the lecture, the generation of the MHC peptide complexes for T cell receptor recognition. One, MHC class 1 and class 2 molecules deliver peptides to the cell surface from two distinct compartments. Peptides presented by MHC class 1 are generated within the cytoplasm, or the cytosol of the cell, aka the endogenous pathway. Peptides presented by MHC class 2 molecules are generated in endocytic vesicles. The reason why they're acidified is eventually the membrane of that vesicle will permeate, releasing the MHC class 2 peptide complex so it can then be transported to the cell surface. And this pathway is exogenous because it really refers to engulfment by phagocytosis or endocytosis. Now, this is a very interesting thing, which I really didn't talk about before, but dendritic cells have the capacity to present even an exogenously taken up protein through both class 1 and class 2 pathways through a process called cross-presentation. So cross-presentation allows exogenous proteins, which are taken up by phagocytosis, to be presented on both MHC class 1 and class 2 molecules. And only dendritic cells can do this. Other antigen-presenting cells, like macrophages and B cells, lack this ability. That's why antigen-presenting cells of this type, of a dendritic cell, are really the most effective cell to activate naive T cells. CD8-positive T cells recognize MHC class 1 peptide complexes, and CD4-positive T cells recognize class 2. So this summarizes those important concepts. And now there's a reason why, there's going to be a reason why I want you to know all that information. Because of the second part of my talk and a video I'm going to get to. So, before I move on to the second part, I think I just wanted to end this part of the talk with, okay, so how does a T cell kill once it becomes an effector cell? So here is a cartoon also illustrated from the textbook, and it highlights important steps First, once you get your T cell, once it's converted from a naive to an activated cell, through recognizing either viral peptides or tumor peptides presented by the dendritic cell, these cells now have the ability to then migrate through blood, infiltrate lymph nodes, or go to tertiary sites, which could be any organ or tissue of the body. It could be your liver, it could be your brain, it could be your pancreas, the prostate, the breast, and so on. So now they're circulating in the blood, and if they find your target, again, it could be an infected fibroblast or epithelial cell that lines your lung as a result of a flu infection. It could be a tumor growing in your prostate. If your T cell finds that, there is a cell-cell interaction, very much like with the antigen-presenting cell. Conjugate formation, again, you need to form a tight conjugate, and again, this is assisted by some of those adhesion molecules I referred to, LFA1 and CD2 on the surface of the T cell, interacting with either ICAM1 or LFA3 on the infected cell or the tumor target. Those interactions, again, just like with an antigen-presenting cell, help form a stable complex enough for the T cell to initiate its lytic program. Now, T cells, and again, kill through multiple mechanisms, but the mechanism I want to highlight here is a mechanism that's called granulin exocytosis or degranulation. So, cytotoxic T cells have these little granules inside their cytoplasm. These granules are cytotoxic proteins. And it's these cytotoxic proteins that interface with the target cell through a cell contact dependent fashion. They then deliver onto the cell membrane of these targets, where they actually create holes in the surface of those cells. And then through a series of events, through damage of the membrane, as well as a series of other events to the nucleus of these target cells, that target cell will die. Now, it's very important to point out, and it's very interesting with target cell killing, is that the T cell doesn't need to be attached to that target for a long period of time. Once the T cell delivers its content, these lytic proteins, these lytic granules, the T cell could detach, circulate, and reattach to more targets and kill them. Exactly how many they can do is not clear, but they can do it multiple times. So you can have a T cell tumor interaction for about 30 minutes. The T cell will detach, and the tumor will eventually go on to die hours later because of the damage created by the insertion of these lytic proteins. The mechanism of death is typically apoptosis, and I'm sure you've learned about apoptosis in previous lectures. These proteins have the capacity to cause damage not only to the cell membrane, but also to the nuclear membrane, and also to proteins important in DNA replication and repair, leading to DNA fragmentation and eventually apoptosis. That's how they kill. Okay, so why is all this important? Well, it's important because now I'm going to switch all to cancer. So keep all that information in mind because these concepts are going to be important, not just for this part of the lecture, but it also explains why it's important to understand basic science and how you can use that basic knowledge to develop better therapeutics. So I'm going to make a circle with this. At least I hope I will. So let's talk a little bit about cancer. And again, this is a very brief overview. You've had many lectures on cancer. Okay. Now, for the longest of time, we as scientists, oncologists, cell biologists, have thought that cancer develops purely through intrinsic mechanisms. Genetic and epigenetic alterations within normal organs and tissues. That's true. It all starts with those hits. But is it enough? So, in elegant work, this is just an example of a really nice review published back in Science a few years ago by a scientist, physician, named Bert Vogelstein at Johns Hopkins. And I hope one day he does win the Nobel Prize, and I think you're recording me on that one, because he was one of the first scientists who mapped the pathogenesis of cancer. In that case, he mapped it in colon cancer. And it really illustrates the power of this knowledge. And it could take many years before you go on to develop a solid tumor. So, the pathogenesis of solid tumors, whether it's colorectal, lung, breast, prostate, and others, could take many years because of these events. So you can start with normal colonic epithelium, and then it progresses in a very interesting pattern. You go to small adenomas, large adenomas, eventually carcinoma and metastasis. And along these different steps, you need to accumulate a variety of different genetic and epigenetic changes. That is absolutely clear. But is that enough for the tumor to really survive, proliferate, invade, and metastasize? Short answer is no. Here's a review article, again, published a few years ago. The reason why I liked it, because I like the table, I like the way they presented this information. If you were to biopsy any tumor, could be the lung, breast, prostate, pancreas, it doesn't really matter, and look at it under the microscope histologically, which pathologists do every day, they usually score it for cancer. Is it benign? Is it malignant? What stage? Grade, etc. But what they don't really study in detail is what are the other cells within that tumor tissue. And if you look at tumor tissue, more than half is not even cancer. That's the most surprising thing. More than half is not even cancer. These are normal cells, cells derived from you. And if you were to look at and identify these cells, at least in this review article, which I thought was a nice summary, identified at least 23 different cell types that infiltrate that tumor tissue. In this case, it could be breast, it could be a variety of different types of tumors. Okay? And many of them, and you can see here, are just normal cells. You have fibroblasts, you have adipocytes, you have endothelial cells, you have, of course, your T cells are there, you have B cells, you have platelets, and you have a huge myeloid compartment, including dendritic cells, various types of macrophages, neutrophils, and mast cells. So the question is, why are they there? Is it just a random event of circulation and they got trapped? Or does this have any causal impact on the process of tumor progression and metastasis? So even though that's interesting, it's just descriptive. So, long story short, the best way to do that with human data is to do very interesting correlative studies. One way to do a correlative study is to look at the relationship between the appearance, density, and proportion of cells in relationship to survival outcome. That's a very good way that we do it in translational research today. If something is relevant, does it have an impact on survival? So again, if you were to look at, in this case, by immunohistochemistry, this is taken from another study in Science, you can see that if you look at normal breast tissue, normal mammary tissue, you can see, based on brown, there are very few circulating leukocytes, as defined using an antibody against the protein called CD45. CD45 is a protein expressed by all leukocytes. If you were to look at a patient with invasive ductal carcinoma, which is one of the most common types of breast cancer, you can see a large fraction of this section is infiltrated by leukocytes, okay, which verifies what I was trying to say about these non-neoplastic cells that reside within tumor tissue. What this shows you is that it's not just breast cancer, but a variety of different tumors. In this case, they summarize work from breast cancer, lung cancer, esophageal cancer, and mesothelioma. So many of these cancer types, if you look at them under the microscope, are housed with non-cancer cells. And if you break it down based on what they are, you will see a variety of CD8 cells shown in red, CD4 cells shown in blue, mononuclear cells such as monocytes and macrophages and dendritic cells shown in a different color, B cells and so on. You can see that they contain these leukocytes and they come in different types of subsets. But does it really matter? And the answer is yes. This is, again, just one example of many studies out there that show a relationship between the type of immune cell, the numbers of these immune cells, and the relationships among them that are highly predictive for survival. So, this is a Kaplan-Meier plot in breast cancer of many patients. And if you were to score these tumor biopsies, again, that we sent to pathologists every day, for these characteristics, you would find, based on what I said, CD8 positive T cells are critical as cytotoxic T cells, right? So if the basic knowledge has any value at all, you would say that patients that have high levels of cytotoxic T lymphocytes should have a better outcome. And the answer is yes. So if you have tumor tissue where these brown spots have a lot of CD8 positive infiltrated T cells, and a low frequency of a certain population of macrophages, these patients will survive a whole lot longer than those patients that have a lower infiltration of CD8-positive cytotoxic T cells, with a higher frequency of patients with a certain type of macrophage response. The nature of the macrophage response is not relevant for this issue that I'm talking about. But what it does tell you is that the numbers, the frequencies, the densities, and the relationships of these various leukocyte populations really have predictive value. These are just two different studies. So, the take-home message is that in addition to intrinsic changes in normal tissue leading to frank malignancy, there are extrinsic mechanisms, which I refer to as the host-tumor interaction. And depending upon the nature of this interaction, they can have positive or negative consequences on the tumor outcome, as shown here. So if you have a high CD8-positive T-cell infiltration, that will have positive predictive value, and patients will live longer. On the other hand, if you have lower frequencies of these cells, as shown here or here, it will have a negative outcome and patients will not live as long. It's not just breast cancer. This has been shown in many different cancer types. But I do want to illustrate this important point in breast cancer.
What controls the concentration of those cells?
It's an excellent question. Nobody knows the answer to that question. You can test it in mouse models. Some of it is probably due to the types of tumor factors that affect or interfere with T cell infiltration. So if certain tumor types, for example, produce factors like IL-10, TGF-beta, VEGF, prostaglandins, you will either have less T cell infiltration, or if the T cells infiltrate, they are more likely to die from apoptosis. That's an excellent question, and I do recommend, just for peripheral reading, you guys received a review article. I think it's a great review article that summarizes a lot of these concepts. And I think if you read in a bit more detail in the area about immunoevasion, it may provide some more insight to your answer. But the broad issue really deals with what is unique about the biology of the cancer that then in turn impacts the immune response. So it's not necessarily the immune response that's the issue. It's how the malignancy impacts shaping the immune response. And if we can figure that out through a variety of different therapeutic modalities, then you can alter that balance. And that's where the basic science comes in, because if you can understand why in one case you have low infiltration, in another case you have high infiltration, then perhaps you can bypass that to create a setting where you have higher infiltration. So, how do we treat cancer? Well, this is an obvious slide, but it's going to get back to, as you can tell, we can get back to immunology. So, we know that surgery, you ask any surgical oncologist, they're going to say the only way to cure cancer is to cut it out, and that's true. Assuming that there's no evidence of invasion or metastasis. So the three major approaches really deal with surgery, radiation, chemotherapy. And the old saying was slice, burn, and poison. That's what they use. That's how we treat patients with cancer. Slice, burn, and poison. Those are the methods that we use, and we've been using them quite effectively for many, many decades. So surgery is used to debulk a large mass. It's very effective and even curative if it has not spread. Radiation is very useful for local or regional tumor spread. It could lead to draining lymph nodes. Chemotherapy is used for widespread or systemic disease. But the approach is generally a toxic, particularly to cells that replicate at high efficiency, like follicles, epithelial cells that line the GI tract, and your bone marrow. Those are highly replicative areas for cell production, and generally that's where you're going to see toxicity, because chemotherapy affects cells that are very active. And it's because of these toxicities, it limits the potential use of chemotherapy. Now, chemotherapy does work. The problem is that the therapeutic window tends to be smaller than we hope, because you have that fine balance between the damage you do to the malignancy versus the damage you do to your body. So, immunotherapy is now becoming the fourth modality. This is a field that's been growing for the last 20, 25 years. And it's based on the principles that I talked about. And the whole idea is to improve how the patient responds against their own cancer, assuming that you have a competent immune system. Most patients with cancer have competent immune systems. They just don't see it. So every day of your life, and again, you can read about this in the review article, there are three major phases of the immune cancer interaction. The first phase is elimination. If the immune system sees it, doesn't grow. And we would think that all of us right now, because we're human and there are defects in self-regulation, that there are transforming events that are happening. It is the job of your T cell system to see those changes and eliminate them before they progress. That's called elimination. But in cases where there is not elimination, there's this long stage of what we call equilibrium. That is where the immune system coexists with the developing tumor. And that may explain why some people, it takes 20, 30, 40 years before you see malignancy, because the immune system is one of the mechanisms to keep tumor growth in check. But eventually that's going to fail, leading to the escape phase. So escape really reflects the inability for the immune system to control it at all. Think of it like antibiotics, right? Again, many of us can deal with colds and certain types of GI bugs, right? The immune system works like it should. But in some cases you need help and you need an antibiotic, because the immune system cannot work, you know, as effectively, because the pathogen is outbalancing post-defense mechanisms. It's the same way in cancer. The immune system needs help because the cancer has overwhelmed the host defense mechanisms. So the question is, If that's true, how do we get the immune system to work better? There's two general principles and two general approaches. One involves vaccines, very similar to what we all got as children, very similar to the flu vaccine. All you're trying to do is either amplify your pre-existing population of T cells or de novo induce a new population of T cells reactive against your particular tumor. The other one is adoptive cell transfer. It's almost like a transplant, where you expand cells with a certain type of specificity ex vivo in a culture dish, expand them to large numbers using IL-2, and then reinfuse them into the patient in a way to alter the balance between your immune reaction and the cancer. Now, if you can infuse 10 billion cells that are specific for your tumor, now you really alter the balance in favor of the immune response. So this is active immunotherapy because you're trying to induce an immune reaction. Adoptive cell transfer is passive because you take the cells out, you expand it, and then you reinfuse using that as a medicine. So the rationale and goals for immunotherapy as a fourth modality is it's highly potent immune reaction. Again, I talked a lot about the specificity of the T-cell receptor. Single T-cell receptor, single MHC peptide. That's how exquisite it is. And it targets cancer with a high degree of specificity because of that T-cell receptor. And because of that specificity and selectivity, there is virtually no toxicity against normal tissues. So here you are exploiting a fundamental principle about T lymphocyte biology for therapeutic purposes. But again, that's just the idea, but does it work? Another result, getting to the point of immunotherapy, we're trying to build an argument why we need better ways to treat patients with advanced disease, inoperable disease, or disease that has failed conventional therapy. Because of metastasis. Most cancer patient deaths are due to metastasis. Again, most cancers really are adult solid tumors. You have pediatric, adolescent cancers. Many of those cancers happen to be cancers of bone marrow or lymphoid tissue. But the vast majority of patients with cancer on this globe reflect solid tumors, and many of them, 90% or more, die from metastasis. So again, if you're trying to make an argument we need better ways to treat patients with cancer, why not consider the immune system? And again, metastasis is not accessible to surgery. It can give rise to many lesions at multiple locations, many of which can be small and undetectable. Again, another reason why you would want to consider a patient for this type of treatment. So, how can we manipulate the T cell response for therapeutic purposes? So based on basic biology to clinical practice, you can manipulate the immune reaction based on these three signals, the three signal model I was referring to. So in regard to signal one, we now have at our disposal for treating patients dendritic cell-based vaccines. As I mentioned, dendritic cells represent the most potent antigen-presenting cell you can find. And if you can manipulate it in a way to immunize a patient against their tumor, it becomes a very powerful vehicle in immunotherapy. So dendritic cell vaccines expressing relevant MHC peptide complexes. You can do that now in the laboratory. In fact, patients with prostate cancer, and I'm going to show you a video in a few minutes, that illustrates the concept and really talks about, hey guys, this is a real therapeutic medicine for patients with prostate cancer. It's being used in other cancers as well. Signal two, I talked a lot about co-stimulation. And again, by understanding that axis, we have now developed ways in which we could affect co-stimulation. Now, one thing I didn't talk about at this point is negative co-stimulation. I mentioned in order to activate a T-cell, you need positive co-stimulation. So if you go back to the early slide, I think I called it positive co-stimulation. But just like with anything, the immune reaction also needs to be turned off. So under normal conditions, you get T cell activation. When the pathogen is cleared, the last thing you want is lingering T cell response. So what happens in normal biology is that what builds up must come down. So the immune system has negative co-stimulation. So as a consequence of turning off the immune reaction, the T cells upregulate a different kind of receptor that could still interact with CD80 or CD86. But instead of delivering a positive signal for IL-2 receptor upregulation and IL-2 production, it leads to a downregulation of those events, and then you silence the immune reaction. Negative co-stimulation involves the upregulation. Negative co-stimulation involves the upregulation of two major, there are multiple types of receptors on the surface of the T cell that are upregulated. The two most notable in the literature, and I'm sure you may have seen commercials about this, involve antibodies that target CTLA-4 receptor on T cells or another receptor called PD-1. So again, under normal conditions, these receptors are turned on after T cell activation to silence the T cell response, and that's their purpose. T cells do their thing and eliminate the pathogen, but then they're turned on by a variety of different mechanisms. These are two examples. Basic science led to these discoveries. Basic science led to discoveries of ways in which you can block these interactions. So in the case of cancer, you don't want these molecules expressed on T cells, because the moment these molecules are upregulated on T cells, the T cell response will be turned off. And if you think that T cells are relevant for the anti-tumor response, you want to do everything you can to sustain that T cell response. One way to do that is to develop an antibody that binds to these receptors. And if you bind to those receptors and you antagonize engagement of CTLA-4 or PD-1 on that APC surface or that tumor cell surface, you will now keep that T cell active for a longer period of time. So, by understanding co-stimulation led to the development of novel therapeutics, these are monoclonal antibodies that interfere with negative co-stimulation. How many have seen commercials on Optiva, on lung cancer? That's an example of an antibody that targets PD-1 in patients with lung cancer, and it's very effective, I mean, in patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer. There are other cancer types where PD-1 and CTLA-4 are being used, particularly in kidney cancer, melanoma. Doesn't work in all cancer types, but I do think with a little bit more science, I think we'll be able to figure it out. And again, I believe that review article talks about how do we make these particular reagents, which we call checkpoint inhibitors, work better. Again, signal 3. For a long time, oncologists and immunologists have been using interleukin-2 exogenously, where you just make a lot of growth factor and inject that growth factor directly into patients. IL-2, as I mentioned, is a major, one of the most important growth factors for T cells. So again, if you want to expand your T cell pool, why not inject IL-2? And adopt a T cell transfer based on these concepts. So benefits of clinically engaging the anti-tumor T cell response against cancer. So a word about adoptive transfer. So I said there are two major approaches. One is through active immunotherapy, which involves vaccination, such as dendritic cell-based vaccines, or passive immunotherapy, which involves collecting T cells from the patient, expanding them in a dish to very high numbers and a very high degree of specificity and lymph potency. And you can do that in the lab. And then return them to patients. And these were methods first applied by Steve Rosenberg at the National Cancer Institute, where I used to work before I came to Roswell Park. I didn't work with him, I worked in a different lab at NCI. But I used Steve Rosenberg, I want to say fairly well, but I knew him and his work, and I've always respected his work. He's one of the pioneers in this technology, and he was the first to show how effective this technology is in patients with melanoma. So again, this illustrates the concept of isolating T cells, in this case from melanoma lesions. So you can collect a melanoma tumor lesion. You can digest that using enzymes to break it up. You then take these fragments, use, I don't know if you can see here, but certainly you notice, you now take advantage of signal 3, which is high doses of IL-2. You expand them, and then you can clone them. You can isolate T cell clones with whatever affinity, specificity, and sensitivity you would like. And then you return them to the patient. And this is just an image of what it could do. So if you now reinfuse these cells through a vein and wait even a couple of weeks later, this is what a melanoma lesion looked like on this particular patient. And within 2 weeks of an adoptive T cell transfer, that lesion disappeared. Again, the power of the adaptive T cell response against cancer. It's real. The issue is, how can we go from 20 or 30% effectiveness to 50, 70, 90, 100% effectiveness? So we know that these technologies work, but they don't work in all people. And again, it gets back to your question. And as a scientist, those are the questions we go after every day. Why does it work in some? Why doesn't it work in others? Let's understand why it works, and maybe we will begin to understand why it doesn't work, to be able to understand how we can get it to work. Okay, so cancer vaccines actually are much more appealing than adoptive T-cell transfer, because adoptive T-cell transfer is more synonymous with precision medicine. It's very costly, but the point is, it does work. It's not yet FDA approved. That could be used here, for example, at Roswell Park. I mean, you would have to be involved or enrolled in a clinical trial. So it's not FDA approved as a treatment. So if you have a family member that has, let's just say, breast cancer, and they want to be treated with adoptive T-cell transfer, you can't do it. You know, you may get adriamycin and other types of chemotherapeutics, but you're not going to get adoptive T-cell transfer unless you're in a clinical trial. But cancer vaccines are most appealing because you would think, hey, if you can vaccinate somebody against polio, tetanus, diphtheria, you know, with the same reagent, why can't we do that to everybody with breast cancer or prostate cancer? Why can't we develop a universal vaccine effective for those cancers? So it's much more appealing, and it could be used in a broader population of patients. So again, a similar concept to classical vaccination, where you now immunize the patient against their own tumor, using fragments of that tumor that would either expand a pre-existing immune reaction or lead to the induction of a new immune reaction, very much like any type of vaccine that you received. Now, two great examples of vaccines in use right now, and I'm sure you're familiar with Gardasil, or the HPV vaccine. That vaccine is based on this concept. In this case, it really works better because HPV is a virus, and it's more likely you will generate a more potent immune reaction against viral epitopes compared to other types of tumor antigens that I won't talk about today, but there are tumor antigens that are reflect various stages of cell differentiation and development. Those types of antigens are more likely to be weaker antigens than antigens derived from oncogenic products or from viruses. So cervical carcinoma is an example of a cancer type where the etiology has been tightly linked to this particular virus called HPV, human papillomavirus. A number of years ago, companies developed a vaccine where you can actually immunize women and now men, young women and young men, where you can induce a potent HPV vaccine. Now, in women, it was meant to prevent cervical cancer, and it's extremely effective. the idea with men is that, again, there are certain types of cancers that are linked to HPV. One good example could be head and neck cancer, which may have an HPV component. So here's an example, again, taking technology and exploring the concept of vaccination to the point where it's now being used globally. The one on prostate cancer is called Provention. That's the one I'm going to show a video on. And this takes advantage of the dendritic cell as a vaccine product. Okay, so I think that was my last slide. And now I'm going to show a video. And in that video, it's about this product. I'm not trying to sell the product. I'm not trying to sell the product in any way. I want to get that on record. But I do think the video really covers a lot of the concepts that I talked about and also gives you an appreciation of the power of taking basic knowledge and exploiting it for therapeutic purposes. So before I turn on the video, do you guys have any other questions for me? Like the exam answers? No, I'm not going to answer that one. I do have 11 points, okay? In fact, I already have the exam made. I'm going to send it to Anand after I'm done, but I want to make sure I covered all the points because I remember the questions I'm asking. My questions are going to be short answer. I think I covered all the basic points that I wanted to. Again, study the lecture notes. This has been recorded, right? So if anything is unclear, listen to the tape. If that's not clear, just please send me an email and we can set up a time to meet. Okay?
ProVeg Sequencel T is the first and only FDA-approved personalized autologous. It's cellular immunotherapy. It is indicated for the treatment of asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic metastatic castrate-resistant hormone-refractory prostate cancer. ProVeg activates the power of the immune system to extend survival. The body's normal immune processes are designed to protect against harmful agents. Specialized antigen-presenting cells, or APCs, act as a key component of the immune system by engulfing these harmful agents. The engulfed agents are then processed into fragments and presented as antigens on the surface of the APCs. Upon maturation, the APCs activate T cells, which proliferate, and attack cells that express the original antigen. The immune system also has memory. Some activated T cells become memory T cells, which remain primed to initiate an immune response in the future. But prostate cancer is an immunoinvasive disease. Prostate cancer cells can invade or inhibit the body's normal immune processes. This immunoinvasive ability helps make it possible for cancer cells to grow and spread largely unchecked. ProVeg works differently than other approved prostate cancer therapies. With ProVeg, the patient's immune system is activated to target and attack prostate cancer cells. The creation of a patient's personalized dose of ProVeg begins with leukapheresis to extract immune cells, primarily immature ADCs. Then, at a ProVeg manufacturing facility, the cells are cultured with a recombinant antigen, PAPEGM-CSF. PAP is an antigen expressed on more than 95% of prostate cancer cells, while GM-CSF, an immune system activator, supports APC maturation. As the patient's APCs engulf and process the recombinant antigen, they begin to mature and present the antigen on their surface. This processing occurs outside of the body to support APC activation and maturation by removing the cells from the immunosuppressive environment created by the patient's cancer cells. After 2 to 3 days, the fully matured APCs have become ProVeg. When the it is transported to the physician for infusion. Once in the patient's body, PROVEG activates the patient's own resting T cells and induces their proliferation. Activated T cells are one of the immune system's strongest defenses against cancer cells. The PROVEG activated T cells are able to recognize, target, and attack PAP antigen expressing prostate cancer cells, resulting in an immune response against the cancer cells. In the pivotal phase 3 clinical trial, PROVEG extended median overall survival beyond 2 years in patients with metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer. In this study, the sustained immune response to PROVEG was seen up to 26 weeks, the last time point measured. PROVEG has an NCCN Category 1 recommendation for first-line treatment of men with asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer. Activate the power of your patient's immune system. Treat first-line with PROVEG to extend survival. PROVEG is intended solely for autologous use.
You don't need to hear that part. That's the all the information about side effects and things like that. Oh, I'm no longer on the record. Okay. Okay. That covers all the lecture material. And again, if you have any questions, I'll hang around for a few minutes. If not, good luck on the exam, or just send me an email, and I can meet with you to go over some material that you may have questions about.
No, we have.